You're listening to another podcast from education.au.
So for the final hour today, another opportunity for Jimmy to prove that he can actually answer every single question, except for six of the questions that Andrew asked him yesterday at the Chaser. So, what we're going to do is, this is a casual conversation. I'm not going to monopolize it because this is about pair production, and the pair production of questions is as important as the pair production of answers. So I'll start off by asking two questions, cover some territory that maybe I feel needs to be explored in a little bit of depth, and then we're going to alternate between you and me for the rest of the hour. So, Jimmy.
Hello.
Welcome. Good to see you here.
Thank you.
So,
maybe we could turn my mic down a little bit.
He's a little hot over here. Having started and watched sort of die half stillborn three different wikis now, and also hearing from people and organizations who probably really like to and would benefit from a wiki, one thing I've been able to sort of get out of this is to understand that although wikis are extremely alluring and return a lot of benefit, they have a sort of disproportionate entry cost. That in their early days, you put a lot more in than you're liable to get out. And you know, you remarked about this with three articles in Wikipedia, but you had 100 people on hot standby maybe to help you out. So how does a community get over that hump, whether that's an organization or a civic group or whatever it might be?
Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, the thing that I would say is that five to 10 people can make a decent wiki. I like to see 20 to 30 active, then I'm really comfortable and confident. But that, it doesn't take a lot of people, but still 5 to 10 people who are committed to coming in regularly and checking up on something can be a challenge. When you start off and it's just one person or two people, and maybe you put out the word in your community and you think you're doing okay because you got 5 or 10 people contributing the first couple of days, but they don't come back. And you don't really yet have 5 or 10 regular people who think of themselves as being part of that community and that it's something they should be doing all the time to contribute.
So is that almost like the entry fee then? You really do have to have those 5 people committed?
I think so, yeah. And oftentimes we see that it takes one person who's really, really committed to basically do things like meet and greet people, thank them for their contributions, make them feel appreciated, make it worth their while. I can tell a couple of stories. One story is of the Swahili language Wikipedia. And in this case, there's a wonderful guy, Desanjo. He lives in North Carolina in the U.S. He's from Tanzania. And he felt that there should be Swahili Wikipedia, so he started working on it. He worked on it every single day for month after month after month. He wrote something like the first 75 articles all by himself. He blogged about it. He emailed bloggers. He reached out to academics. And slowly but surely, he built a community. And now it has taken off. Now there's a whole group of people there. They're past that 1,000-article threshold. They were up in the New York Times. You know, all of these positive things have happened. But it really wouldn't have happened had he not been there plugging away month after month after month. And doing all that social stuff, not just writing the content. Some people think that the secret of making a successful wiki is to seed it with content. Well, that can be helpful, certainly if people show up and there's stuff there that they can work on that already exists. That can be helpful, but it's not really the answer because it's about the social phenomenon of a group of people who are committed to working together on something.
So is it leadership? Is that the quality, or is it persistence, or is it, what is that?
It's leadership, I think, but part of leadership is persistence, right? And it's leadership. There's a phrase that I've learned that I really like a lot, servant leadership. Mm-hmm. And the idea of servant leadership is You lead the community not like a general leads an army with command and control. You lead the community by being there to do whatever they need you to do, right, by serving their needs, by following the community. I always say, you know, I can't lead the Wikipedia community to go anywhere unless they already want to go there, right? Right? If they already want to go there, then you can have a role in coaching and guiding and encouraging that kind of thing. So I think that's a big part of it, is the idea of servant leadership. And then I wanted to tell a different story, though. So that was the story of one wiki that became successful in that manner. Another sort of a humorous example is at Wikia we have a site called Furry. Furry is about, there's a subculture of people who like to dress up in animal costumes. And they have conventions, and there's a whole subculture around this, and they have fan art, and they write stories about each other, and they play out characters, and there's more of them than you can imagine. Well, the Furry Wiki started just like that. In the first month, the guy who founded it, he came in, Green Reaper, and he suggested it, and we said, okay, sure. And then in the first month, 100 people came and edited, and they had immediately they had 30 or 40 regulars, and they've got 5 or 10 admins who are really, really active in the site. And so there's a whole community there, and the way that happened was there was already an existing community out there who were collaborating in writing things. They had discussions. They had message boards. They were already an existing thriving community who simply needed this tool. For them, it was a software tool that they needed. They needed a place to let this happen. And so they were able to immediately do that. We've seen other cases like that. So when we talk about there may be this need for plugging away for quite some time before you can build a community, there can also be cases where if you already have an existing community who is accustomed to doing stuff online and they're accustomed to emailing back and forth Word documents, they will thank you very much that they don't have to do that anymore because they can just do it right on the wiki. So sometimes it catches fire very quickly. And I've not yet been able to predict which or which. So it's a little hard to tell sometimes.
Okay, you have been just on this trip, South Africa. I'm looking at schools in South Africa. Earlier this year, you were in India. I assume that you've seen schools both in first world countries and third world countries. And I'm wondering if, given what you see as Wikipedia evolving as a tool and also education evolving as a tool, do you have a vision for what education is becoming in the 21st century?
Not really. I have some ideas. I actually tend to personally be a little bit of a traditionalist about this in the sense that while I think that a lot of learning tools are incredibly valuable and students are going to be using computers and technology in new and interesting ways for peer learning and so forth and so on, I still think there's something extremely valuable about the teacher-student relationship as a one-on-one relationship. I'm hoping that rather than if we view this technology as competing with traditional teaching for educating students, I hope we don't look at it that way. I hope we look at it as these technologies are a way to free up more time for teachers to do a lot more one-on-one assistance. In other words, if you're standing in front of a classroom doing essentially performing your own video, right, you could be replaced with a video, right? The idea of this is particularly prevalent in many universities. I don't know how the situation is in Australia, but in a lot of American universities, the first level classes, there are these huge 300-student lecture sections where the professor is a tiny speck down there lecturing to a great... This is absurd, right? We could replace this with a video, right? This is really not a valuable use of a professor's time. And usually that professor may not be the most entertaining. Like, they could have gotten the most entertaining professor to give it on video and the students could just watch it. Instead, what I like to see the value of a teacher is in that one-on-one, real-time diagnostic assessment. You see, you know, the kid is sort of struggling with a math problem, and you sit down for a moment and you say, what's the problem here? And they say, I don't get this, and then you explain it, I get it. they can move forward so much more quickly. So if we have more students who are doing sort of some of the routine learning in other ways, then maybe that gives us more time for the teachers to be able to actually assist students directly more.
Now, well, you've upset this apple cart a little bit, because the other thing that you've thrown in is it's not just knowledge and mentorship flowing from the teacher to the student anymore. All right, what Wikipedia says implicitly is that the knowledge and the mentorship can flow not just from teacher to student, but from student to teacher, student to student, and teacher to teacher.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. My daughter just embarrassed me badly the other day because she knew that Kampuchea and Cambodia are the same place. And she said something about Kampuchea. She said, "Dad, do you know where Kampuchea is?" The answer was supposed to be Southeast Asia. I said, "Isn't it near Cambodia?" And she's like, "Ah, it's the same place." She's 6 years old.
Where did she learn this fact?
From her mother, and from she has some songs that she listens to. She's memorized. She knows more about geography than anybody in this room, I think. So.
And does she play with Google Earth? Is that where she learns it, or is she just reading lots of books about geography?
She reads books, and she listens to these songs. She has a computer game. She doesn't use Google Earth, though. It's a good idea. We should get her hooked up on that. But we're actually homeschooling my daughter. And so maybe that may tell you something about my ideas about the importance of individualized instruction.
All right, we're going to go for our first question from the audience.
Jimmy, it's Andrew Wilson here.
Oh, okay, now wait. That was, I want to preface that then. You're my plant, and you were supposed to be my second, but it's all right. Okay, Jimmy? It's all right, Andrew, we'll let you go first.
Plant, wait, there was a plant. Is this going to be 10 questions?
Yeah, no.
That was the plant yesterday.
That's a different Andrew. What we've done is we've set up a case study for you, something that we'd like you, while you're here, to give us your thoughts about. Andrew.
Okay.
I'll try again. My question, Jimmy, is open after I give a bit of background. It's really about, does anything jump out at you from your experience that might be able to help me? I'm working in Victorian government in the Department of Sustainability and Environment in the area of managing fire. And fire in Victoria in the natural environment is a huge deal in terms of its losses and its costs, the survival and the health of ecosystems, and just the sheer number of people that it affects. Everyone in this room nearly would remember have been affected last summer when 60 lightning strikes in one afternoon joined up to create one mega fire that burned over 2 million acres, translated that for you, in 2 or 3 months. Besides anything else, it nearly caused Melbourne to lose half of its water supply for the next 50 years, the water that it hasn't got. So, good fire for a fireside chat. I'm managing a project to help shape how we as a government department and we as a community in Victoria address our management of fire into the next decades. And I picked out just a few angles to try and help illustrate. The issues themselves are very numerous and complex, technically, environmentally, socially. We live in a democracy where a government department exists to meet the needs of the citizens, not to tell the citizens what they should have. The community more and more wants to be hands-on and to be involved. The stakes are very high, and that can be a personal impact in lives, houses, livelihoods, community values, economics, state and regionally, and very importantly, the ecosystems themselves, the survival of them. Now, more knowledge is implicated in all of this, but concerns me that more data is not necessarily more knowledge. It may even be counterproductive sometimes. And more knowledge is not necessarily better decisions, better outcomes. Knowledge is differently held in that one person's truth is another person's speculation or complete mistruth, perhaps. And the whole mix is important. It's not helpful if the majority rules, if we only have one answer, or the earth would still be flat. To move forward, I don't see this as being primarily about capturing all this knowledge and sharing it online, but somehow about bringing knowledge together and how we play the game. So if that's not too complicated, any thoughts from your experience?
Well, yes, a few thoughts that might be a little bit helpful in some ways. Some of the most interesting stuff that goes on around Wikipedia and in the Wikipedia community is not so much the end product, which is this fabulous, enormous, changing, flawed collection of knowledge, but a big part of what I think has been innovative and interesting about it is the decision-making processes that have arisen within our community for making these kinds of editorial judgments, absent a top-down hierarchy or with only a very light, loose hierarchy that may or may not have any actual authority when it comes down to it. And so some of the kinds of things that we see within Wikipedia, we try to avoid very much democracy in the sense of voting. Voting can be a very flawed method of making decisions about editorial content, and I think this would probably apply as well to some of the kinds of things that you might be trying to decide or to create documents around, which is the issues around voting are that, you know, if you look around the room and you see that you've got about 70% support for something, then you're very likely to just dig in your heels and ignore the 30%. But very often the 30% have some sort of a valid point that they're trying to make. What I think is more interesting is to think about decision-making processes that don't encourage people implicitly to dig in their heels, but to encourage them to continue to adapt the idea so that it's acceptable to more and more people. So when you've got to make some difficult choices, you know, very often the kinds of choices that we face around environmental issues would be, you know, a situation where, well, on the one hand, if we build this road, it will go through some sensitive areas, and that's bad. On the other hand, people need to live somewhere. They need a more convenient way to get to work, and that's also important. And these are very difficult trade-offs. I think in many cases, voting-style processes encourage both sides to yield just enough to get a majority to win, and it blocks us from thinking about solutions that are compromised solutions that are actually better for both sides. So I think that a wiki-style process where you have many different people, not getting this started and encouraging active participation may be tricky. One of the problems that we often have is that people aren't nearly as engaged in the political process as they should be or could be. And I think part of the reason is the style of decision-making that we've had in the past alienates people from politics. It's not a participatory system, therefore there's no point in participating for many people. If you could get people from very diverse viewpoints within the community to come together reasonably and say, look, we've got some difficult choices to make around policies, choices we're going to have to make that are going to affect you know, our vulnerability in various ways to fire, in this case, you might be able to bring these people together and find that, gee, there's actually a lot more common ground than you traditionally would have recognized, that people actually do have a fair amount of agreement, and then that can pave the way for a consensus document of recommendations that would get broad community support. And it isn't written by one side or the other, it's written by the whole group. Another aspect of this, too, is if you're familiar with the film 12 Angry Men, which is a great movie, but watch the old one, not the new one. I watched them back to back, and it's astounding to see how nearly the same script can make for a really horrible movie or a really great movie. But the original was really fantastic. And the premise of 12 Angry Men, it's a murder trial. It's all set in the jury room. And it starts out with very quickly, almost everyone in the jury is deciding to vote to convict based on the evidence that they've heard. But there's one guy who says, I'm not convinced. And through the entire movie, it's a process of him one by one by one picking apart the arguments of different people. It's hard to imagine just a bunch of people in a room arguing, making a great film, but it's really fantastic. And, you know, he addresses that, you know, as it turns out, this person was actually fairly racist and sort of made some assumptions. This person didn't really understand the technical evidence and so on and so forth. various assumptions that were made. By the end of the film, he's persuaded everyone in the room, and they vote to acquit. What's interesting about that kind of process is that when a wiki is working well, when the community is healthy and is open to thinking through ideas, you can see that kind of process happen, where you, immediately sort of the group settles in on a, what seems like an obvious consensus, but there's one person who stands there and says, no, we're making a mistake, stop and listen to me. And if you've got a healthy community, they can stop and listen and try to debate it and work it out. A wiki is a really great tool for encouraging that kind of decision-making process and that kind of debate. I could go into some detail about why it's a great tool for that. It has to do with the structure of how the argument is placed. If you have a message board where you've got threaded discussion and I can't delete your comment or I can't modify a document or I can't work on a consensus statement, then we tend to get into this back and forth flame war, people trying to show each other up and be the smartest person in the room. Whereas in a wiki, because it's all collaborative in nature, there really is an incentive to, in the consensus document, if I want my writing to survive, I need to realize that I can't write something that the other side's going to disagree with. I always have to be looking for a way to get something that I can write that this guy here, he totally disagrees with me, but I've got to think about that. I've got to say, okay, well, I know if I just say, you know, the answer is stop all development outside of this perimeter because that's going to lead to whatever and it's going to cause more fires, that this guy's going to totally disagree because he owns that land and he sort of wants to build some apartments there. So if I think about that, then I can start to say, well, okay, well, how could we have a collaboration here? How could we get some of what he needs and some of what I need? And then I can write that, and I have an incentive to write that by the very structure of the software. So those are some of my thoughts. I don't know if that was what you were aiming at.
All right. I'm your fairy gobsmacker, and for the next 10 minutes, you are benevolent dictator of planet Earth.
Yeah, this is what I've been waiting for.
And I want you to design a new copyright regime, because, you know, we've heard it persistently this week, but you hear it persistently all the time. Copyright is broken. It's not allowing us to evolve to the sharing place we need to be. What would you do? And, I mean, there's nothing left. We got rid of the old copyright regime.
Okay. That's a good one. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is that in the U.S. in particular, in order to come into line with world standards, we changed our copyright law so that by default, everything that you write is under copyright. This was not a bad idea that came from the U.S. This is a bad idea that came from elsewhere that the U.S. agreed to. And it's now essentially universal. And this happened just before. It wasn't done in order to screw up the Internet. It was done just before everybody realized how big and important the Internet would be. So that right now, by default, you have to do something to put things into the public domain. And it's not trivial, actually, to put something truly into the public domain. The closest you can get is like a Creative Commons attribution license. So I think that was a mistake, because if you just imagine all of the tons and tons of stuff that people put online with no interest in the copyright at all, they're putting up fan pages or they're putting up information about whatever, and they're not trying to make any money out of it. It's not intended to be copyrighted, but it is by default, and that hampers our ability to share. People have to make some affirmative action of learning about Creative Commons licenses. You have to know enough about copyright to care. Most of this that can go on kind of casually. People just put a statement at the bottom of a page saying, you can take this if you want to, but they're forced to do that. So one of the things that I would say is let's have a regime where by default things are not under copyright. Okay? Well, then lots of people do need protection of their work for a limited period of time, and that's a very valuable economic incentive. It also respects people's moral rights in certain ways. So for that, then the registration should be quite easy. But now we live in a world of Internet where it would be quite trivial to be able to just mark your work. All you have to do is put a copyright symbol on it and say, "That's, you know, there's my copyright. I've said that it's copyrighted." But that should be the default, that it's not copyrighted unless you say so. And if you say so, it is. Then additionally, how long should your copyright last? Okay. One of the issues that we face right now is that copyright has been extended and extended and extended to absurd lengths. But I think that the extension of copyright to such absurd lengths is not driven by anybody in this room or any, well, maybe some of the organizations, I'm not sure who all's here, but mostly it's driven by Hollywood, by the movie industry and other industries that have long-lived intellectual property assets that they need to protect the value of. My view of this is I don't really care. I think if the political cost of getting some positive change is to say to Disney, you know what, you can have Mickey Mouse for the next 200 years, that's fine. We're not going to worry about that because there's a huge amount of collateral damage in this ongoing campaign to keep extending copyright to protect this group of movies. Right now we have a very much of a one-size-fit-all approach to copyright, although I was actually intrigued to learn. I saw in the newspaper this morning in Australia there was a ruling about the court ruled that the copyright of a design of a boat was invalid because it wasn't an artistic work. It was a functional work. And apparently under Australian law, there's a separate act, a Design Protection Act, that they could apply and get just 10 years of protection for. Well, I have no particular opinion about the details of that law. I don't know that much about Australian law, but that's the kind of thing that I think is a good idea, is to recognize that we need multiple options. Different kinds of work should be protected in different ways. The purpose of copyright, the beneficial purpose, is to incent production of various kinds of works. For software, do you think life plus 90 years is a reasonable term of copyright for software? That's a little crazy.
Life plus probably 9 months.
Yeah, well, not the life of the author, though, because there's a lot of great software.
The life of the computer.
Right, the life of the computer. Well, no, seriously, I think we could say the life, you know, the expected economically valuable lifespan of a piece of software is far less than 90 years. And we have to concede that we're not just protecting the investment in that piece of software. We're actually protecting the companies who will further produce software later on when we know an alternative mode of production. If the original version of Excel, right, had a 14-year copyright, I don't know if it's 14 years old now, but it must be getting close to that.
Yes, easily.
If it was 7 years, right, then as soon as that became available, the free software community could have taken it up, brought it up to modern standards, and we would have a free competitive alternative. That's pretty much in our self-interest, and I am pretty sure that 7 years, for an old version of the software would not prevent the creation of new versions, right? That's going to go on anyway. So I think, you know, recognizing that we should have different lengths of copyright for different types of work. And then the last point that I would make, and I'm probably leaving out several because I'm just bringing all these things that I think about all the time to the top of my head, is the idea that, bring back the idea that after a relatively short period of time, you have to actually file and re-register your copyright and pay a small fee in order for it to be renewed. This would allow a huge volume of work that is not of economic importance to fall into the public domain with minimal difficulties. Right now, that just doesn't happen. There's tons and tons of academic textbooks that were produced 15 years ago, went out of print. They're now what we call orphan works, meaning it's a work, it's copyrighted, but it's not in production. It's not economically feasible under the copyright regime to reproduce that work. But I can tell you, if you gave me a 15-year-old chemistry textbook free of all rights because it's in the public domain, I can give this to the Wikipedia community, the Wikibooks community, and we can update that and fresh that and make a modern new textbook much more easily than we can operating from ground zero. This wouldn't affect Disney, for example. If we said, look, every 14 years you have to pay $10 to renew the copyright on Snow White, I think they can afford it, right? I don't think that's going to hinder them, but it's going to allow tons and tons of work that nobody really cares about to automatically fall into the public domain rather than this unbelievably arduous process of tracking down the rights, asking, and so forth to get the released. So those are some of the things that I would say I think need to change. Then there's patents. And all I'll say about that very quickly is that I think software patents are a really bad idea. I'm not an expert on patent law in general, so I have no really strong opinion about what is needed in the drug industry. But I do know that the drug industry really drives patent law. In the software industry, most of the major software producers will tell you that they don't find patents helpful. They protect their work with
copyright.
They're
defensive more than
defensive more than anything else, and they actually are a hindrance to innovation. Particularly, a patent of a term, again, the one-size-fits-all principle comes into play. A 14-year term of copyright makes absolutely no sense at all if we're talking about Amazon.com's click on one click to buy something, right? They have a patent on the idea of that you can buy something with one click. This is a ludicrous patent to start with. I think they know it's ludicrous. They did it. I think they originally filed it defensively, but then they used it offensively. They got a lot of grief about that. But the point is, even if we conceded that that was a legitimate patent, which I don't think so, surely the period of time needed to incentivize the creation of something like that was about 6 months, right? If they said, hey, we got this great new idea on the web, we want to patent it for to protect it because we've invested in some researchers to develop it, 6 months would be plenty, right? Because the pace of innovation on the web is so fast that a 14-year patent is absurd.
And one click is not brain surgery.
It is not brain surgery, right? Yeah. And there's a lot of reforms that could be made around patent law in terms of you know, how we define when a patent is granted and how we define obviousness, right? Lots of stuff gets patented that is really obvious. And patents are a real threat to a project like Wikipedia in a way that copyrights are not. With copyrights, we know for sure we wrote it all ourselves, and if there's anything in there that we didn't write ourselves, we can delete it. And you can actually know whether or not you violated copyrights. With patents, you can violate a patent without even knowing it, right? And a lot of times, these patents sort of sit software patents, but they aren't as powerful as they should be, and the unelected parts of the EU keep almost passing this, and it's kind of an unhealthy situation.
Do you have the... I guess that gentleman gets the microphone. Thank you.
Jim, I just want to ask you, what do you think of... I'll give you an example. At home on my wall, I've got a certificate which is... lifelong member of the Australian Performing Rights Association, which is the same as AMCOS.
The Australian BMI. What association?
Australian Publishing Rights Association.
Okay.
The same as AMCOS or BMI.
Okay, uh-huh.
Okay. Yet on the other side of the room, a parade of my four teenagers come in filling up 3 or 4 terabytes of hard drive with downloaded songs. And they've never bought the music. They've never paid for any music. And 3 of them out of the 4 have never been into a music store. So isn't this all a moot point about copyright? Because in the next 10 years, when that generation starts to move into the workforce, are they just going to throw it aside? Or do you think there'll be a reality check with them?
So, I think there's going to have to be a reality check around what we consider to be fair use. I think there's going to have to be some substantial changes in the way music is marketed and sold and the way musicians are paid. I have no idea what the answers are to that. I mean, I'm watching the trends with as much interest as anybody. I know for me, I buy all my music from iTunes because it's a whole lot easier than getting it off the file sharing networks, which is full of spam and it's kind of difficult. And anyway, whatever, it's only 99 cents. Now, I'm different from a lot of teenagers in that, well, I have enough money to buy the amount of music I want, which is not very much. It wouldn't occur to me to want terabytes of music because I just don't need that much music downloaded. I don't think that this all makes copyright moot. I think it basically says, look, we have to accept and understand that technology is going to make certain kinds of copying easy and prevalent. And some kinds of non-commercial sharing are going to go on beyond what perhaps the record companies would like to see happening. But, you know, they fought against, they were very upset about cassette tapes, right? The fact that consumers could record on a cassette tape was considered to be the death of the music industry. The famous Sony Betamax case, right, where there was a huge fight about the ability of consumers to record and time shift programs. All of these technological changes have been fought against by the content creation industries, but in the end, things change a little bit, but there's always some way for people to recoup the costs. And I just think we're going to have to accept it. At the same time, you know, copyright would also say, well, it's one thing if we look at the law and we say, look, teenage kids are going to download a lot of music and they're not going to pay for it. That poses a problem if you are trying to sell music to them. At the same time, we can say, well, yes, it's perfectly fine to say, you know, you can't set up a commercial service selling that music when you don't even own it, right, or doing other kinds of things around that. So I don't know what the future holds there, but I think it should be interesting. I think, you know, very basically, a lot of the ideas that people have around trying to make this work for a longer period of time are just doomed to failure. Digital rights management is just a ludicrously stupid idea that's already, I think it's really exciting that we're seeing, you know, Apple came out and said, Steve Jobs said, we don't care about DRM. And one of the music companies responded and said, oh, well, we don't care either, and they're going to sell without it. Because they're beginning to realize that the service that they're offering it's about convenience. It's not about trying to control. And the idea that because it's digitally protected, that nobody's going to be able to rip it and share it, that's crazy. I mean, that's as long as the content is available in some human readable format, meaning I can see it with my eyes or hear it with my ears, then it can be re-ripped. And you know, the idea that we're going to have technological solution to this copying problem is just not valid.
Okay. We're going to change gears a little bit and talk something a little personal, I think, to both of us. You know, there's a new line that's going around, in the future everyone will be famous for 15 megabytes. And I was looking at my own page on Wikipedia last night, and I noticed, and fortunately there's no wireless in this room, so probably won't be able to check it immediately, that I'd been added to a new category. There's a category, 1962 births, VRML, a couple of other things, and I'd been added to a new category. And I didn't really want that on my own bio page, although it's true. And the last time that this happened, there was something else that made it on there, and I have my personal shill, and he gets an email, and he edits it, because I don't want the edit log to show that I've been doing it. And you
hire her to do it.
You, of course, have been dinged by editing your own page. And the thing of it is you and I could edit our own pages as much as we like, and that doesn't mean they're going to stay edited.
That's for sure.
So in this world that you've launched us headlong into, I'm wondering, how are we going to come to terms with too much truth, with too much sort of being known about us?
So this is a really interesting question. So for Wikipedia and for Wikipedians, the issue of biographies of living people is one of the most important and most difficult to wrangle with. If we put Queen Victoria into a category that she wouldn't approve of, she's not really coming and complaining about it, right? She just lets it be because she's quite dead. And it's the living ones who are the problems, right? So within our community over the last year or two, there's been a really strong movement towards much deeper thinking about how do we handle this? How do we deal with biographies of living people? How do we make sure that when somebody does have a concern that it's handled with sensitivity, that it's handled in a thoughtful manner? And sometimes we still fail in this just because of the sheer noise around Wikipedia. You know, you may make a comment on the talk page of the article, and then some jerk may come along and yell at you, and then you assume it's an administrator. That's quite common. I get emails, your employee, I demand you fire this employee who yelled at me. I demand you remove this person as an administrator, and I go and look, and it's like, not an administrator, right? It's just a random person. Those kinds of things happen, and we don't always respond well from a customer service point of view to people who have a biography that they have a problem with. So we're really trying hard to make better systems for dealing with that, really educating the core Wikipedians and making sure everybody's on board with this understanding that not everybody who comes to a bio and has a problem with it is out to whitewash their career or hide the truth, right? They may have actual knowledge about themselves that we're lacking, right? In my own case, one of the interesting things about my biography is it's gotten a lot better over the years, but the only way I knew of to make it better under the rules of Wikipedia is to become a more public person about various aspects of my life. So there have traditionally, you know, I remember in the very early days it listed, you know, different things that had been said in the handful of magazine articles that had mentioned me, and a mailing list I moderated in college, which is about as unimportant as you can imagine, but it was findable on the internet, right? So somebody found it and added that. And so the biography was very skewed, and I'm assuming this is something I had never really thought of before, but I'm assuming that for most well-known people, there is this really strange thing in the media that certain parts of your life become known, and then a story or a narrative is constructed around that. Mm-hmm. When you know, gee, that it only looks that way because you only know these three things, right? And you're getting a picture of me that's at odds with everything else that I know. I've been trying to get it known that I have an interest in sailing around the world. Mm-hmm. I keep telling reporters this, and no one will ever write it.
Well, it'll be on the podcast
so,
now.
There we go. Maybe somebody will put it. Because, you know, if you look at this and you see what appear to be my list of interests, it's quite odd, right? I have, 20 books about sailing at home. That's not mentioned anywhere. And I have 2 books about the Second Amendment, and I'm allegedly quite interested in it because it was mentioned somewhere at some point. And then reporters ask me about it, and I'll say, yes, I'm interested. Not that interested, but well, it's still...
You didn't brandish your gun after you said, yeah, I'm interested.
Exactly. So so those kinds of things are quite odd to people. So, and one of the difficulties around this, as we've grown, what's become difficult, it's become difficult in 2 ways. 2 things have happened. First, Wikipedia has become incredibly popular and powerful with Google. So I haven't tested this, but I think if I type your name into Google, the biography of you in Wikipedia is almost certainly on the first 10.
Yeah, I think
second
it's
second or third.
Three,
right?
Maybe.
It's typically where it is.
Yeah,
so,
3 or 4.
So you will have seen it, right? In the early days of Wikipedia, when we weren't that popular and we didn't show up so highly in the search engines, well, we could write whatever we liked about you because you might not even stumble across it, right? Then the other thing that's happened is we've gotten larger and larger and larger in terms of the content. You know, if we have an article about George W. Bush or Michael Jackson, they really don't care what people write about them on the internet. They are so over it because people write all kinds. So, I mean, I don't see a little whiny email in my inbox from George W. Bush saying, hey, you know, you got my date of birth wrong or something like this. But from as we have more and more articles, we're reaching people who are less and less famous in various ways, right? And so we went from, you know, major famous politicians to local politicians, from the you know, most popular best-selling authors to authors who have several books to authors who have only one book, their first book, which they just published, and very little is known about them. And those people are not ready to say, I don't care what people, you know, right. It's on the internet, people say all kinds of stuff, it can't be any worse than what the New York Times said about me, you know. They're like, hey, this is my place in history, it seems quite important, right? This is the encyclopedia article about me, and they really get quite agitated if they feel that it's not fair in some way. So, what's the solution to that? I think right now the discussion in the community is an ongoing discussion about what level of notability should people have before we have an article on them, and also what should the proper impact be of a person's stated desire to not have an article about them. Right. That's a really tough question.
Yeah, but this is an interesting point because I did not want to make my own biography page on Wikipedia. It's just, it's wrong. Right?
Yeah.
There's the ickiness about it. But one of my friends actually did it for me as a birthday present.
Uh-huh.
And the first page they made immediately got flushed because he had no idea about the biography guidelines.
Right, yeah. And that can be a difficult thing, too. I guess my friend Dana, who will be speaking next in the seminar series, a friend made the bio page about her. It's been nominated for deletion more than once. And, you know, she's a graduate student at Berkeley. So people say, oh, this person's not important. This person's not noted. And then it became realized, actually, she's very important and very noted, even though she hasn't finished her PhD yet.
Right.
She's had a huge impact on her field and a huge impact on our industry. But what she actually wrote a blog post about this. What was really strange to her is that somebody put a little screen capture of once when she was on Fox News and cited a couple of other media sites, and she said, this is really feels strange to me that with all my academic work, what made me notable is that I was on Fox News, right? Which is pretty, not really her thing, right? So so she kind of thinks that whole process is odd, and certainly it can be very upsetting to people when you see your organization or yourself posted for deletion from Wikipedia, and then there's a little debate about whether or not you're important. It feels very existential, right?
It did. It felt extremely existential.
It's like, oh dear, you know, am I important or not? Wikipedians shall decide, right? But we really feel like we want to modify some of those processes. So we've already done some things like, one thing, we used to never blank those debates. Those debates were available. The first thing we did was make them inaccessible to Google. So because, the only thing worse than searching for your name and finding the Wikipedia article about you is searching for your name and finding the discussion about how unimportant you are. Right? So we took those out of Google. So Google doesn't index those. But now we've actually started a process whereby if somebody says, you know, if you saw this and let's say your article had been deleted and you didn't like that this discussion was on there, we just blank it. We just say, yeah, that we don't need to keep all that. We can blank it in a way that no one would not naturally run across it, but that it can be resuscitated if we needed to review it internally later on. So there's a lot of interesting stuff like that about biographies. And then in this particular case, to go on a slightly different tangent, categories are very problematic because a category is very much either or, right? You're either in the category or you're not. The tag is either on your page or you're not. Versus most text is very free-form, and you can have a lot more nuance around it. So, one example is the category criminals is always a problem, right? Criminals. Who should be in that category or not? So let's say we have a politician, right, who is caught driving under the influence of alcohol and receives a fine, just like every normal person. Well, there'll be people who don't like that politician who will put him in the category of criminals, right? Because, well, he's got a conviction for drunk driving. Well, no.
Happens a lot in Victoria.
Happens a lot everywhere, I think. So, but no, I mean, generally we would say, in our normal, natural understanding of the word, we wouldn't say that someone who has one fine for drunk driving is a criminal in that sense. That's not the way we normally use the word. In the text of the article, that incident can be treated appropriately, and people who disagree about it can find some compromise. Is it important enough to be reported on? Well, for a lot of politicians it is, because politicians are often quite sanctimonious about people behaving themselves, and then they don't, and it can be relevant, but it can be placed into context, whereas a category tag, maybe not. And maybe it belongs or maybe it doesn't, and that can be tricky. And even some categories can be inherently biased by their existence.
Yeah. Or just provocative.
Provocative. So what category are you in?
Read the whole tag. That's not even the whole tag either. There you go.
What was it?
Psychedelic advocates and proponents.
Advocates and proponents. Interesting.
Mark takes drugs. Not right now. And I don't advise children do it, but I think for grown-ups.
So the problem being,
of course, that now the entire world knows. Thank you.
But how did we find out?
Because someone has been editing my page who knows there's an entire body of my work that Australia simply doesn't know about, and I've been very good at sort of keeping those worlds from colliding until now.
Until now.
All right. In part because I was emigrating and I didn't want Amanda Vanstone to know. All right. I have permanent residency now. So when I saw it last night, I didn't file off a letter to my shill going, oh, God, delete this, because I'm figuring, okay, you know, there it is. And so you're right. It's forcing me out of the closet in that respect.
In a certain sense. And the other thing that it can be is what we call undue weight. Undue weight's really bad in a biography. So if you have an enormous body of work that is what you are known for, virtual reality modeling language, various works about the future of the internet, and I actually haven't read all your works, so...
You will.
You will. I will, yes. And you've got this enormous body of works, let's imagine, and let's imagine that the only thing on this topic is you made a mailing list post one time, or you made a blog post that said, gee, I think these laws are too restrictive, and I actually don't see anything wrong with people doing this sometimes. And then we place you in that category. So of the four things that you are, this is one of them. That seems undue weight, right? It's implying something. Versus if you have, you know, written multiple columns for magazines and you have a whole section of multiple books that cover this topic, then
public
maybe
lectures
it makes more sense.
All around the world. That
all
would
that
do
kind
it.
Of thing. That would probably
damn
do it.
It. All right. So I apologize. I'm going to throw a final question at Jimmy. It's been my real pleasure to spend the week with you, and I'm saying this not just on my stage, but it's been a real delight. And I want to comment on something, because I've seen it repeatedly, because it's been my pleasure to know Tim Berners-Lee, sort of when he was in the middle of making the web a big thing. This is 93, 94. Brian Behlendorf, who I knew before he created Apache, when he was just the systems administrator at Apple, but gave the world their basic web-serving software, and now you. And the thing that I found with all three of you is that you're remarkably humble people and you're remarkably ego-free. And I lived through the whole early dot-com era, and you could not be in the same room with most of those egos. So what is it? I mean, you've been with Wikipedia long enough, I'm suspecting, well, did you have your ego beat out of you at the beginning? Or no, because when you're interacting with a community, that can happen. That's part of it. Or is that part of the secret?
So I think it's some of both, right? I always talk about a very early incident in Wikipedia when the Spanish Wikipedia, there was a huge break in the community and the Spanish Wikipedia left. And a lot of people left from that community and started a competing project. And it was over a dispute about the impression that I was planning to put advertising in Wikipedia. And I felt that the people who were putting that forward or misinterpreting what I had said, which is what I've always said, about that. And basically, I felt they were lying. I felt they were trying to trick people into leaving to go join their project. And I was really, like, at them about it, right? And I really called them on it in a very dramatic way. And it didn't work. It didn't come off well. I was really kind of combative in an unnecessary way. And additionally,
in other words, you violated the first rule of Wikipedia, which is what? Don't be a dick.
Yeah, yeah. Although they start no, assume good faith actually would be it, right?
Right?
I should have assumed that they were lacking some context of knowledge, and that if I could explain myself more clearly. The other thing I learned is don't try to have an argument with someone for the benefit of an audience when your opponent speaks the language and you don't. So I'm arguing with this guy, and he's translating to tell people what the argument's about. I didn't look so good, right? So, so part of that, there were things like that where I learned very early on, hey, you really, if you're going to lead this kind of community, you really have to relax. You have to let stuff roll off of you. You can't be this egomaniac jerk, and you have to be very humble. But I also think maybe a part of it is like in the open source world. So I know Brian Behlendorf. I just was with him in Africa, and that was the first time I had met him. And what a great sweetheart of a guy.
Sweetheart
and,
of a guy.
And just very, you know, Larry Lessig and I were, we sort of embarrassed him because we introduced him to Richard Branson as the guy who freed the web from Microsoft, right? And he just blushed. He's just like, guys,
it's true.
It's true. It's 100% true, right? And he doesn't, you know, he just can't think of himself in that way because he's that kind of person. And I think there is a certain amount of Linus Torvalds, people say I should meet him because we're very similar in personality. I don't know if that's true or not. I've not met him. But I think it's in this open source collaborative world, if you have a certain type of personality, if you get into a disagreement with somebody and it's more important to you to win than to end up being right, then you've got a problem, right? And you won't be able to lead a community because people will be able to see that. And so when people disagree with me, there's lots of cases where I've been wrong and I'm ready to say, yeah, you know what? I totally blew it. I was wrong. And if you can't do that with volunteers, you're just dead in the water, right? If you work at a company, you can be the boss and be a jerk, and it's going to hurt your company in the long run. But, well, people will
You'll get to the IPO.
Yeah, you'll get to the IPO.
And then it'll right? all exactly. implode.
And then which is what happened in a lot of those places. Yeah. But, you know, even in a large existing companies, you know, you'll have high-level managers who are complete jerks, and it's not good for the company or their department, but you can get away with it because the people under you, well, they get their salary, and they think the place is a terrible place to work, but they at least get a salary, so you can get away with it for a while. With volunteers, it doesn't work from day one. If you try to boss people around who are volunteers, they'll just leave, right? They'll just be like, you know, I'm here to share knowledge and help humanity. I'm not here to get yelled at by Jimbo. So they'll just leave. So you just have to be as nice as you possibly can. And I'm not perfect, of course. So occasionally yell at people, but...
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Jimmy Wales for his contribution today.